But 2 Corinthians chapter 5, and the verse that I would like to share with you is verse 17. Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creation. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. That is a reality. If any man or woman be in Christ, he or she is a new creation. Not the same person. Old things are gone. Created into something brand new. It's called redemption. It's called regeneration. It's called the new birth. I've never preached a message like this ever in my entire ministry. This June, I will celebrate 40 years in the gospel ministry. In those 40 years, I've never preached a message like this. And if I preach another 40 years, I probably will never preach a message like this. This is very different for me. But I want to give you a real life testimony of the verse that we just read. And I want to talk to you this afternoon about the greatest man I have ever known. And that man is my father, Edwin J. Baldwin. My dad was born March the 1st, 1907. The same year that Marion Morrison was born. You probably know him as John Wayne. The Duke passed away in 1979. My father passed away on February the 4th, 1993. So just a few days ago, on Wednesday, to be specific, marked the 22nd anniversary of my father's passing. And it was that event that God has used to stir my heart to bring this message. After Dad first passed away, I thought seriously about writing a biography of his life. Well, that's been 22 years ago, and I still haven't gotten around to writing the biography. Always too busy. If I ever did retire, which I never will, I could spend probably the rest of my life writing some books that I would really enjoy writing. Since that probably will not happen, this message is probably going to be as close as it comes to that book. My dad was born in the little village of Lake Michigan. Yes, I'm talking about a village. I'm not saying my dad was actually born in Lake Michigan. He was born in the little village, population of only a few hundred, Lake Michigan. His mother, my grandmother, who was a direct descendant from the old Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany, had developed some physical problems. And the doctor in Michigan at that time suggested that they move to the Ozark Mountains for her health. And so when my dad was only a little baby, they moved to the Little Rock, Arkansas area. And it must have worked because my grandmother lived to be 83 years of age. Dad was the oldest of five children. Three boys, two girls. Each child was almost exactly 5 years apart. His father, my grandfather, was a deacon in the Christian church, devoutly religious man. When Dad was a little tyke, or should I say even as a little tyke, he had a propensity for troublemaking. So I come by it honestly. One day he stole some small stuff from a store. His conscience got to bothering him, and he went and asked his dad, "Dad, does a person go to hell for stealing?" Remember, Granddad was a deacon in the Christian church. The church he attended taught works salvation, a false gospel. And so Granddad answered him the only way he knew. He said, "Yes, son, if you steal, you go to hell." Too bad Granddad didn't know the true meaning of the gospel at that point in time and could have given my dad the story of God's saving grace when he was a little boy. Might have averted a lot of pain and suffering. So Dad, as a little boy, figured, well, if I'm going to go to hell for stealing anyway, I might as well just go ahead and go all the way, shoot the wad. And that's exactly what he did. He started drinking hard liquor when he was a teenager. And before he was out of his teens, he became a full-fledged alcoholic. A true alcoholic in every sense of the word. By trade, he was a master welder, as good as they get. When my father retired from the welding company that he worked at, the owner of the company told him at his retirement ceremony, he said, "Ed, if I had 50 welders like you, I could lay off everybody else in this company." It was a big company. Dad worked on the St. Louis Arch in St. Louis, Missouri. He did many of the major construction sites of that era around the country. There was never a better welder. Dad married and he had two girls, my half-sisters. Alcoholics react differently to the influence of booze over their lives. No two men or women will act exactly the same under the influence of alcohol. Some alcoholics become extremely mean and violent. Others become very reclusive and passive. The reaction of alcohol in the bloodstream varies from person to person. For my dad, alcohol didn't make him mean. He never beat his wife or my stepsisters. But what it did do to him was it made him a wanderer. He would leave home for weeks and months at a time. Just disappear. No one would know where he was. No communication. Of course, in those days, there weren't cell phones and texting and email and all of that. Probably wouldn't have mattered. He just disappeared. Usually his modus operandi would be to hop a freight train and hobo around the country. He slept in hobo jungles. He traveled all the way from our home of northern Indiana all the way to California, Oregon, Washington State, drove up and down the coast, or rode up and down the coast, I should say, back to Indiana and then go do it again. And he did that many, many times. There's one motion picture that I know of that can give you a fairly accurate depiction of what it would be like to ride the rails in Depression era America. And I've watched that movie, and I watched it with my dad. And I asked him, "Dad, is that a apt depiction of what you went through, what you saw, what you experienced in your hobo days?" And he said, "It's very, very accurate." And if you want to get a picture of that, if you want to get an image of what that lifestyle is about, you might want to get the movie The Journey of Natty Gann. It doesn't depict, the star of the show is not an alcoholic. She's a young lady in search of her father who had to leave for work during the Depression. But she tries to find him, and in an effort to find her father, she is forced to ride the rails, and she sees the lifestyle of people that did that. Of course, when he was gone, what did his wife do to feed the family? He would take all the money that he would earn from his job and he would drink it up. He wouldn't buy groceries. He wouldn't buy clothes. He wouldn't pay the rent. He'd just get on that freight train and travel the country drinking along the way. His first wife put up with that for years and years and years. He always promised he would do better. He would get sober. And when he sobered up, he was as fine a man as there ever was. And he would promise her that I will change. Alcoholics always promise that they will change. But he never did. Finally, Sally got to the point that she couldn't take it anymore. And she took her two little girls and she left my dad. And she had every right and reason to do so. Dad wept over those two little girls, my half-sisters, until the day he died. The regret that he carried, the guilt that he carried in his heart about how he had abandoned those two little girls, and the hunger they went through, and the pain they went through, and the heartache they went through because of his drinking, haunted him until the day he died. Talked about it with me often. And even though he could talk about it and wanted to tell me so I understood, he could never talk about it without crying. Never one time could he talk about it without weeping. So his alcoholism cost him his wife and his two little girls. Not to mention his health was about shot. By the time he was 40 years of age, He was about dead physically. Hard drink taken in abundance does havoc to the human body. And at the age of 40, he looked like he was about 70. And there's no question he was not long for this earth. He tried to commit suicide 3 times. The last time, this is before his wife and children had actually left him officially. He came home and went through the house making sure it was empty. And when he was satisfied that the house was empty, he went and got a shotgun, loaded it, sat on the bed, put the shotgun in his mouth, and with his big toe was just about to pull the trigger. But he had made a mistake. The house wasn't empty. And his youngest daughter, my half-sister, Pat, came in. She was just a little girl. She walked in and she saw her dad with the shotgun in his mouth about to blow his brains out. And she said, and this is a quote, "Daddy, you don't want to do that." Dad took the shotgun out of his mouth. And after all of that happened, at the age of 40, with his family gone, his children gone, his health gone, he decided he'd go to Alcoholics Anonymous to try and find help. I was saying at the age of 40, having lost everything, he went to Alcoholics Anonymous to try and find help. When he got to the third step of the AA program, he came in contact with these words. "We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him." And when Dad read those words, he asked the counselor, "Is this religion?" And the counselor said, "Well, you can call it that, but we don't care what kind of religion." And Dad said, "I don't care if it's religion. I want no part of it." And he left AA and went right back to his drinking. Over a period of months, however, his desperation became so great that he returned to the AA counselor. And so on the third point, the third step, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Dad said, "Well, that makes no sense to me whatsoever, because I don't understand God at all. How can I assent to this step when I don't understand God at all? So if I'm going to go through this program, if I'm going to make it past step 3, I'm going to have to figure out a little bit about God." And he said to the counselor, "I'll be back in a few weeks." So Dad set on a journey to try and understand God. He went to every church he could find in Little Rock, Arkansas. And got no satisfaction and no resolution. Until he walked into the High Street Baptist Church in downtown Little Rock, Arkansas. The pastor's name was Harvey Hicks. And Harvey Hicks was himself a former alcoholic. He met Harvey Hicks, and Harvey began to share with him the gospel of Jesus Christ, the death, burial, resurrection of our Savior, salvation by grace through faith in His shed blood. Well, Dad, being the meticulous welder that he was, very meticulous nature, everything he did was down to the nth degree, had to be exactly right. So as he got ready to receive the Lord, he said, "Well, just a minute, Pastor Hicks." He said, "I got five more churches to check out. I'll go check them out, then I'll be back." That was Dad. Guess what? He came back. And when he came back, he told Brother Hicks, "I want to do it all the way." That was Dad. He never did anything halfway. Never in his life. "I want to do it all the way. You want the Lord to be your Savior, forgive you of your sin, trust Him as your Lord? Yes. Want to believe that He died on the cross for you? Yes. You're willing to follow Him in believer's baptism as a sign of your salvation? Yes." And then he said, Harvey Hicks put his finger right between his eyes, and he said, "And Ed, you're willing to do anything else He wants you to do?" And Dad said, "Yes. I want to go all the way." And by the way, that's the problem with the vast majority of the Christians in our pews. They don't want to go all the way. Making deals with God, playing games with God, they don't want to go all the way. But Dad did. And at this point, I have to pass over some personal things that happened at that moment where God revealed Himself to my dad in a very, very unique and special way. But if you'd ever heard Dad give his testimony, what he would say at this juncture is that, "Folks, I woke up in a brand new world. I woke up in a brand new world. The birds never sang as sweet. The sky never seemed as blue. The grass never seemed as green. I was in a brand new world." He said, "I fell in love with everybody." He said, "Everywhere I'd go, I'd try to tell people about Jesus and tell them what He did for me and how much He loved them." And he said, "It got to be the point after not too long a period of time," and Little Rock wasn't near the big city that it is today, "that he would walk down the street and his friends would see him coming and they'd go on the other side of the street because they didn't want to hear him witness to them." It wasn't too long after he accepted the Lord that he was really bothered, because he'd been an alcoholic for over 20 years, most all of his adult life. He never knew what it was like to not have to have a drink. After a few months of sobriety, he went to his pastor and he said, "Pastor Hicks, I can't imagine me not getting drunk again." He said, "Will I ever get drunk again?" He said, "Pastor Hicks paused for a minute and then said, Ed, I'm not going to say that you will never get drunk again, but I am going to say that you will never have to get drunk again." He said, "I got it." By the way, point of note. Dad was saved at the age of 40. He died at the age of 86. 46 years, not a single drop of alcoholic beverage from the time he was saved to the day that he went to heaven. Not a single drop. An event happened several months later that literally became the catalyst for what my dad's ministry would become for the rest of his life. You got to understand, my dad loved Pastor Hicks like you can't believe. When Dad got the word that Pastor Hicks had died, I remember he came home from work. He told his boss, "The man that led me to the Lord died today. I can't work anymore. I got to go home." And he came home. And he wept. And he told me about his pastor. Pastors don't mean much to people anymore. Not part of it is the reason, because pastors are not willing to tell the truth. But even among the ones who are, there's a definite lack of respect for the men of God. Gossip, backbiting, all the crap that goes on in churches today. God, it must make God sick. You're going to be so embarrassed when you stand before the judgment seat of Christ one day. And you have to apologize to that man of God that only tried to love you and help you and tell you the truth, and you didn't have the decency, the character, or the sagacity to even get it. He told me about his pastor. And he told me this story. He said, "I hadn't been saved, but just for a few months." He said, "I wanted to talk to Pastor Hicks so bad." High Street Baptist was a fairly large congregation at that time, and it wasn't because he was a Joel Osteen preacher either. There was no entertainment evangelism and feel-goodism in Harvey Hicks' pulpit. They probably had 500, 600, 700 people in attendance on Sunday, people standing around. Every Sunday, people stood up for the whole service. They couldn't find a chair to sit down. It was not uncommon for Pastor Hicks to kick people out of the church on Sunday morning in the middle of the service. He'd get wind of somebody gossiping and slandering. He'd get wind of somebody causing trouble. He'd get wind of something that he didn't like as a pastor, and he'd just call them out by name. "Brother Smith, you and your family stand up. Now you all hit the door and don't ever come back. Oh, Brother Jones, we have room for you now. Come over here and sit down." That's not exactly a feel-goodism kind of ministry, is it? He did it commonly. He was hard as nails. But he loved God and he loved souls. He had this, he didn't have an office. Pastors didn't have offices back in those days. And so many of the people in the church wanted his advice on personal decisions that they were having to make. And so he would had one night a week. I think Dad said it was Monday night. He would have one night a week. He would open up the study of his house for people to come over and ask him, not theological questions to debate, and all you didn't get this right on Sunday, and I want to challenge that, not for that, but for true pastoral counsel. And every Monday night there would be a line down the street of people trying to get in and seek his counsel, and he would stay up as long as the line was there. One night a week, but that's the only night. This particular Monday night, there was a horrific thunderstorm in Little Rock, Arkansas. Horrific. Unlike the city had seen in years. No one would dare to be out on a night like that. And it hit Dad. "Ah! Monday night, terrible thunderstorm. Nobody's going to be going over to Pastor Hicks tonight. Let's go. So he got my mom, at that time, my mom, and went to Brother Harvey Hicks. Got to the front door, knocked on the door. Pastor Hicks came to the door. And Pastor Hicks said, "I'm sorry, children. You can't come in." And my dad looked at him in shock. And you'd have to know my dad. I won't say it exactly as he said it. He said, "Harvey, you're the darndest pastor I've ever met in my life. We've come all the way over here in a driving thunderstorm just to visit with you. On the night you've set aside, and now you say, we can't come in." He said, Harvey looked at him. He said, "Ed, one of these days you and I are going to go on a 1,000-year walk. And we're going to talk to our heart's content." He said, "But until then, we have work to do. I just got a call from a lady whose husband is drunk in a bar. And I just got off of my knees praying, Lord, send me somebody that I can send to help this man. And as soon as I said the prayer, you knocked on my door." I said, "Ed, there's no other man in the congregation qualified to do this job as you are. Now you go over there to that bar and you help that man." And Dad did. And Dad started helping the down and out drunks and jailbirds and drug addicts and prostitutes and the kind of people that nobody else wanted to be around. And Dad spent the rest of his life helping those kind of people. It all started that night. My dad came home that day and was telling me about Harvey. He said, "Son, after I see the Lord when I get to heaven, I'm going to ask him if Brother Harvey and I can take that walk. So as far as I know, him and Harvey Hicks are still walking." Of course, after he got saved, he tried everything to convince Sally to take him back. She wouldn't. He later, of course, met my mom and married her. After Pearl Harbor was bombed, World War II came to America. Dad and his two brothers went down to the enlistment office to sign up. My uncle Bud went to the Navy and served in World War II. My uncle Gene went in the Marine Corps and served in World War II. He was wounded. It was either, I can't remember if it was Guadalcanal or Iwo Jima, one of those islands. Uncle Gene was wounded. And they both served with distinction during the course of the war in the military. When Dad went to sign up, the government people that were running the interviews went over his resume as a master welder, and they said, "Mr. Baldwin, we think you can do something better than carry a rifle." And they put him on the Manhattan Project. After the war, God spoke to my dad and told him to leave Arkansas. But he didn't tell him where to go. He just said, "You'll know it when you get there." So Dad left. He didn't know which way to go. God didn't even tell him which direction to go. He just said, "Go." So he started meandering northeast. He was sitting in a little breakfast cafe. One of those deals that's open all night, and he was late at night when he was there. He just got into town. He was sitting there at the diner, and a distinguished man walked in and sat down. Wasn't anybody else in the cafe, and so the two men started a discussion. And the well-dressed man said to my dad, "Well, what do you do for work?" And Dad said, "Well, I'm a welder." He said, "Are you a good welder?" He said, "Yes, sir. I'm a good welder." He said, "You need a job?" He said, "Yes, sir. I need a job." He pulled in his pocket and handed him a business card and gave it to my dad and said, "Now, tomorrow morning, you go over to such and such a place and you talk to such and such a man and hand him that card." And all it had was just his name on it. Didn't have anything else about it, just had his name on it. So the next morning, Dad got up, did what the man said, went to the place, saw the man that he was told to see. He said, "This man," gave him the card, "this man told me to give this to you." The man looked at him and said, "Well, you're hired." And he said, "I'm hired. What do you mean I'm hired?" He said, "Do you know who the man is that gave you that card?" He said, "I have no idea." He said, "Well, that's the man that owns this company. You got a job." That was LaPorte, Indiana, the place where I was born, and the place where Dad and Mom lived the rest of their lives. They lived for a couple years in an apartment on Noble Street, and then when I was just about 2 or 3 years old, they bought the house that I was raised in at 308 L Street, and they lived in that house until he traded it for a mansion in heaven on February 4, 1993. Almost immediately after moving to LaPorte, he began ministering in the LaPorte County Jail. He became later an AA chaplain in the Indiana State Prison in Michigan City, Indiana. And he continued to occupy that position until just a couple of years before he passed away. My dad won literally hundreds of men to Christ. When I got a little bit older, Dad would take me to the prison with him. And that's where I was introduced to the prison culture and the prison ministry and Tiny. Tani was the most powerfully built, muscular, enormously strong man I've ever personally laid eyes on in my life. Tiny was a black man who was serving several life sentences for murder. He stood about, 6 foot 6, 6 foot 7. Wasn't an ounce of fat on him. Huge man. The first time I went with Dad, it really surprised me what I saw, but then as I went back again and again, I expected it. Every time Dad would walk in population, and when you're in population, you're with the prisoners. Everybody's just out walking around. You're not in cells. You're not protected per se. You're out with them, just like a little miniature community or a city. Thousands of men just walking and milling around in this huge area. And every time Tiny, I never knew what his real name was, would see my dad, he would run over to him. And he would grab him like he was a little boy. And pick him up and just hug him. And he would kiss him on the cheek. Oh, Mr. Baldwin, I love you, I love you, I love you. I'm so glad to see you. My dad had won Tiny to the Lord. And Tiny put the word out to the entire population at the Indiana State Prison. And the word was this: anybody in this institution lay a hand on Mr. Baldwin is going to answer personally to me. Nobody messed with my dad. When I was early in the ministry, Tiny would lead a prayer group every day inside the walls of that prison. And in that prayer meeting, they'd pray for each other. And they'd pray for Ed Baldwin. And they'd pray for Chuck Baldwin, Ed Baldwin's son. And that went on for years. Most of those fellows are all gone now. That prayer meeting isn't what it used to be. But I know that there were men praying for me for years and years and years. Many of the churches weren't praying for me. And many of the people in my own church weren't praying for me. But Tiny was praying for me. And there were a bunch of those convicts at ISP that were praying for me every day. In 1957, Harry Saulnier and Jack O'Dell asked Dad to come to the Pacific Garden Mission in Chicago to produce his life story on the international radio program Unshackled. He went and had that production made. That is the production that we give out free of charge to anybody that asks it. It's his life story as dramatized by the Unshackled program at the Pacific Garden Mission in Chicago. Several years later, they asked Dad to come back for a second production. He did. As far as I know, my dad is the only one who has ever had two separate productions of his life story made at the Pacific Garden Mission. They wanted to do a third, which would include my story of going into the ministry, my miraculous birth, and the story of my being in the ministry. But by that time, Dad was considerably older, and he just didn't want to go back to Chicago again. Dad was the greatest personal soul winner I've ever met. He won men one-on-one by the hundreds, maybe thousands, only God knows. But one of the most remarkable, miraculous events in his life happened not one-on-one, but he was invited to speak to the inmates at Pendleton Prison just outside of Indianapolis. The prison held thousands of men. If you know a little bit about your gangster history, you remember that that was the prison that John Dillinger served time in. Let me just take a pause before I finish the Pendleton Prison story. I'm going to say this at the end, but my dad was fearless. Never met a more courageous man than my dad. He was not a big man, but he was a fearless man. But he told me about the day in his hoboing days when he met Ray Hamilton as he was hitchhiking on a back gravel road in, I think it was Illinois, it could have been Indiana, but I think he said it was Illinois. And as he was hitchhiking in the night, this Model T came screeching to a halt, and it was filled with people partying and drinking and carrying on, and they were going to give him a ride. When he looked into the back seat of the car, he saw this man, and he recognized him instantly as the gangster Ray Hamilton. If you know your history, Hamilton was a part of the Clyde Barrow, Bonnie Parker gang. He was the one that Bonnie and Clyde broke out of prison, and in the process, a guard was killed. And that's whenever they got Texas Ranger Frank Hamer and his select team of men to track and hunt Bonnie and Clyde until they got him. And of course, they did get him on May 23rd, 1934, on Louisiana Highway 154. We all know about that story. He saw Ray Hamilton in the back seat of the car. He said, "Son, first time in my entire life, the only time in my entire life, I was afraid of a man." He said, "The hair on my neck stood straight up." He said, "It will happen." I looked into the eyes of that man, and he said, "It was like looking into the eyes of a shark." This was a man that could kill without conscience, without thought. He said, "If I'd have gotten in that car," he said, "they probably wouldn't have done anything." He said, "They were just out partying, having a good time, and they weren't in the habit of killing and brutalizing poor people." He said, "They probably would have just brought me in the car and probably would have drank and had a good time, and they'd have let me out some miles down the road." He said, "But when I saw Ray Hamilton," I said, "No, you all look like you got too many people in the car already. I'll just wait for the next car." And they sped off. He goes to Pendleton Prison in Indianapolis to speak to the prisoners. Over 3,000 men. Concrete walls, steel, bars, floors. 3,000 men. Dad gets up to speak, and the first word that came out of his mouth, and 3,000 men, without moving their lips, for as long as they could hold their breath. You couldn't even hear yourself think. Reverberated off that steel and concrete like a microphone blaring. Waited till it settled down. They ran out of breath and they sat there, and he tried to speak again, and the same thing, 3,000 men. Happened again. The guards were just about ready to come in and shut the meeting down and send all the prisoners back to their cells. Dad bowed his head and said, "God, you calm the waves and the sea. Please calm these men so I can talk to them about Jesus." He went back to the macro stone and began to talk. Not a peep was heard. Not a peep. And he talked to those men for over an hour and a half. And he gave them his testimony. And he talked to them about what Jesus had done for them, about what Jesus could do for them. He was up on a platform, rather high, 3 feet or so. And when he got done, to my knowledge, it's the only time it's ever been done in Pendleton prison, maybe any prison, with the guards looking on and not him not getting permission from them to do what he was about to do. Just spontaneously, he said to the men, "If any of you men receive Christ as your Savior right now in your heart," and he gave them the sinner's prayer. And he said, after you've received Christ as Savior, "I want to shake your hand. If you want to come up here and shake my hand, come up here and shake my hand." And they came down by the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. And he was there for over an hour on his knees on the stage, shaking hands with prisoners that had come to receive Christ as Savior. Never been anything like it in Pendleton prison. My dad was the most dynamic man I've ever known. He was the single most influential man in my life. And I'm not trying to blow smoke here today. This is my tribute to my dad. I am convinced in my own heart that I'll never be half the man he was. Never. Never. Compared to my dad, I feel like the worst possible sinner. There's no way. In heaven, when the rewards are passed out, I don't know how they're going to do that. If it's based upon who gets the most is in the front and who gets the least is in the back, my dad's going to be way up there in the front and I'm going to be way back there in the back. Everything about the way I am today, everything about the way I preach, everything about the way I lead, everything about the way that I approach my work, and if you want to call it my brass and my prophetic type of preaching, whatever that is, whatever the verbalization for that is, it's because of my dad. Before I could read, my dad had me memorize the entire 66 books of the Bible. And I could say the 66 books of the Bible like that. And I didn't even know how to read. Dad worked the second shift from 3 to midnight every day. He'd come home at midnight. Mom had already put me in bed and she'd gone to sleep. But when Dad got home about 12:30, 1 o'clock, he'd go in the bathroom and he'd shave and shower and go get himself something to eat before he went to bed. And when he's in the bathroom shaving, I'd always go in. I'd wake up, wait for him. I'd go in there and I'd talk to him. And so that's, Dad figured, I guess, we're going to make some productivity out of this. And so he said, all right, you're going to memorize the books of the Bible, boy. And he just started out, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and away it went. Every day I'd get up, go to the bathroom. He'd say, all right, where are we on the books of the Bible? Tell me what they are. Dad was as tough as nails. And he was as soft as a feather at the same time. Never seen anything like it. You couldn't buffle him. Oh, he could read through hypocrites like glass. He had no use for pretenseful hypocrisy. But he loved sinners like you can't believe. He could walk into the most God-forsaken hell hole. I don't care how dangerous, I don't care how corrupt, I don't care how evil, I don't care the atmosphere. He could walk into a bar, he could walk into a nightclub, he could walk into any den of iniquity anywhere and instantly win the respect and admiration of everybody in the room and instantly begin to make friends and begin to talk and begin to share his witness for Christ. I've seen him do it. In places where I would be afraid to even step my foot, he would walk in like he owned the place. And by the time he left, he owned everybody's heart in that room. Dad hated religion. Hated it with a passion. Remember when he was a little boy, he went to his dad about the sin of stealing. And the only thing his dad could tell him was, yeah, you're going to hell. By the way, after Dad got saved, Dad led my granddad to Jesus. And Dad led his youngest brother, my Uncle Gene, the Marine, to Jesus. He was a prolific reader. He read constantly. He had a magic way with people. And if you think it was only prisoners that he was magic with, you're wrong. My dad was somewhat of a speed demon. Well, no, he wasn't somewhat of a speed demon. He was a speed demon. He would never own any vehicle except a full-size General Motors sedan with the biggest engine that General Motors made at the time. Nothing less. It had to be a four-door sedan, it had to be a GM, and it had to have the biggest engine on the market. And he got every bit of use out of every engine he ever owned. Every year we would go from LaPorte, Indiana to Little Rock, Arkansas and Dallas, Texas to visit kinfolk for his 2 weeks vacation. Always falling on the first 2 weeks of July. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm here to vouch for the fact there is not a hotter place this side of hell than Little Rock, Arkansas the first 2 weeks of July. And we'd go to Little Rock and Dallas every year. Well, back in those days, there were no interstate. There were no four lanes. It was all U.S. highway. I know all about U.S. 66. Before they ever wrote the song, I knew about U.S. 66. Dad would get his little stash of groceries right next to him in the seat. Peanuts, popcorn, whatever. There was no such thing as a potty break There was only refueling. And you did everything that had to be done when you refueled, and it had to last until that big 30-gallon tank was empty again. And we get on the road. Man, you'd hear that four-barrel carburetor kick in. I'm not making it up. When I'm a little guy, about his age or maybe a little bit smaller, I'm scared to death. I learned how to pray in the back seat of my dad's car. I'm not exaggerating. I'd start out in the back seat with the seatbelt on, and then I would wind up on the floorboard of the back seat praying out, "Oh God, please don't kill us on this highway." He said, "Well, did your dad ever get pulled over?" All the time. All the time. Every time a policeman would pull him over for speeding, I would get real excited. I'd go, "All right, Dad's going to get a ticket and he's going to slow down." The poor policeman would come up, take his driver's license, and, "Mr. Baldwin, you know, you were doing 35 miles an hour over the speed limit." And back in those days, the speed limits were all 70 miles an hour. And Dad would talk. And after Dad talked for about a minute, the policeman would inevitably say, "Well, I'm going to let you off with a warning this time, Mr. Baldwin. Please try to slow it down." I'm going, "Oh, man." My dad never got a single traffic ticket, a single speeding ticket in his entire life. He had to have been pulled over 1,247 times and never got a speeding ticket. I told him when he was in his 70s, I said, "Dad, please slow down. Your reflexes aren't what they were." I mean, what can your reflexes be anyway when you're doing 110 miles an hour? "Slow down." "I will, son. I'm working on it." He wasn't working on it. Finally got in a car wreck when he was 80 years old. He should have been killed. Car was totaled. Nobody was killed in the other vehicle, thank God. Everybody walked away. And Dad walked out of the car without a scratch. He called me up and he said, "Son, I had a wreck." "Well, Dad, you must be okay. You're talking to me." "Yeah, I'm fine. Car's total. Everything's gone. But I'm fine." He said, "But son, I just want you to know, I'm going to start slowing down a little bit." And he did. From the time he was 80 to the time he passed away at age 86, I'm pretty sure that he didn't do more than 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. Pretty sure. The point of that story is that he's just magic with people. Real quickly, I want to give you his four outstanding qualities. The things that have made such an impression for you to understand me a little better. You can understand my dad. And here's where we're going to go to the book of Luke, chapter 7. Luke Luke chapter 7. And one of the Pharisees desired him that he would eat with him. And when he went into the Pharisee's house, sat down to meat, and behold, a woman in the city, which was a sinner. When she knew that Jesus sat at meat in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster box of ointment, stood at his feet behind him weeping, and began to wash his feet with tears, and did wipe them with her hair of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee which had bidden him saw it, he spoke within himself, saying, "This man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that toucheth him. She is a sinner." She was probably a prostitute. If not a prostitute, a very loose woman morally. And everybody knew her reputation. And Jesus answering said unto him, knowing his thoughts, "Simon," this is not Simon Peter, this is Simon the Pharisee, "Simon, I have something to say to you." He said, "Master, say on." "There was a certain creditor which had two debtors. The one owed 500 pence and the other 50. When they had nothing to pay, he frankly forgave them both. Tell me, which of them will love him most?" Simon answered and said, "I suppose that he to whom he forgave most." And he said unto him, "Thou hast rightly judged." He turned to the woman and said unto Simon, "Seest thou this woman? I entered into your house. You gave me no water for my feet. She hath washed my feet with tears and wiped them with the hairs of her head. Thou gavest me no kiss, but this woman, since the time I came in, hath not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil thou didst not anoint, but this woman hath anointed my feet with ointment. Wherefore, I say unto thee, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she hath loved much. But to whom little is given, the same loveth little." And he said to her, "Thy sins are forgiven." That's the problem with most of us. We don't think we've been forgiven much. We're too good. We're too perfect. We're too holy. We're too righteous for Jesus. My dad was like that woman. He knew what he was like. He knew the sins that he had committed. He knew what God had forgiven him from. And his humility for the Lord was overwhelming. I would sometimes come in on him praying, "Oh, that was worth more than a Bible college education, I promise you." When he prayed, he was talking to a Savior that had saved his wretched soul. And here was a man that loved God with all of his heart and all of his soul and all of his strength. If Dad taught me anything, he pounded into my head the sovereign grace of God. He pounded into my heart That we are nothing without Him. That everything is from Him. Everything is for Him. Everything is due Him. That His sovereign grace in our lives is everything in our lives. That we can claim no honor, no glory, no credit for any of it. That God gets all of the glory, all of the honor, all of the praise. Son, don't even think about trying to take praise for yourself. Don't even think about trying to take glory for yourself. We deserve nothing. It's all of God's amazing grace. I learned that at my Father's house. Every once in a while, you'll get one of these stubborn, carnal, backslidden, so-called Christians who thinks that their ministry, their calling in life, is to keep the pastor humble. I actually had a woman one time tell me that. I'm called to keep you humble. Let me just set your minds at ease, folks. God doesn't need you to keep me humble. God's grace and love and mercy ought to be plenty enough to keep each of us humble. Deep humility. Boy, did He drill that in me. Number two is honesty. If Dad told you, I'm going to meet you at this place at this time, 1 year from now, he will be there at that place at that time, 1 year from now. He never lied. His word was his bond. He got that from Granddad. Granddad was that way. Even though Granddad didn't know the Lord until Dad won him to Christ, he was a very honest man. You don't have to be a Christian to be an honest man or woman. I know some people that are not Christians who are more honest and straight than people that call themselves Christians. When Granddad was going through the Depression, and nobody had anything, except the elite, of course, there was a local merchant that had a typical small town dry goods store, a little bit of everything. And when Granddad could not afford or could not raise the food, or could not kill the food, and he needed something from the store, he would walk in and he would take it. And the owner of the store said, "Mr. Baldwin, you just pay me when you can." The owner of the store never even wrote down a single thing that Dad took from the store. He never wrote a single thing down. He just said, "Mr. Baldwin, pay me when you can." The owner of the store never wrote a thing down, but Granddad wrote every single item down and exactly how much it cost. And he kept his list. And as the Depression went on, the list got longer. But finally, things turned around for Granddad. And he began to pay back every single debt that he had. And when my granddad died, he didn't owe a man in this world a single cent. And Dad got that kind of honesty from my granddad. And that meant when Dad told me, if I did such and such, I was going to get a spanking. There was no bluffing here. I'll spare you some of the stories in that regard. Let me just say this. I learned early my dad was a man of his word. He was a courageous man. I've seen him walk into some of the biggest, strongest. We're talking about men that are serving life sentences for multiple murder. They have nothing to lose. Talking about men that could snap your neck and take your life in a millisecond and never give it a second thought. It wouldn't mean anything. They wouldn't suffer one bit more than what they're already suffering. I watched him walk up to a group of men that were, this was in the prison, and they were angry with him, and they didn't like his gospel message, and they were expressing deep hatred. I watched him walk up to those men just like they were his best friends. Never bat an eye. Never take a step backward. And say just exactly what he would say. And it wasn't always bubblegum and Fritos either. He had an office in the Indiana State Prison where people would come in, where the men would come in by appointment to talk with him. And they didn't know really why they were there. They were there because they had nowhere else to be and place to go. They would come in, Dad would sit down. Every man, it was the same thing. The first thing out of Dad's mouth, and again, I'm going to paraphrase and I'm not going to say it the way he said it. He would look at that man one-on-one across the desk and he would say, let's just get one thing straight right off the bat. He'd look him straight in the eye and he'd say, these are murderers. These are the worst, the meanest of the mean. He'd look at him and say, I don't give a darn whether you ever get out of this prison. Whew. Because they're all shooting an angle trying to get out. They're all shooting an angle trying to get out. They'd get mad, blood, red face, neck, veins stick out. They'd stand up, fists clenched. And then Dad would say, now sit down and let me talk to you. And for the next hour, he'd tell them about the Lord and the grace of God and the forgiveness of sin and salvation of the soul. Hundreds of men to Christ. Sometimes when Dad walk into that prison, it was like a rock star had just walked into the prison. Men by the dozens and scores would surround him, tears in their eyes and joy in on their faces, shaking his hand, hugging him, making him feel welcome and loved. He'd won them to the Lord. And lastly, his compassion. His humility, his honesty, his courage, and his compassion. Wow, did he love people. He loved the kind of people that nobody else would love or wanted to love. When he passed away, and he made me promise to do this before he passed away. If he hadn't made me promise to do it, I don't think I could have done it. But he made me promise to do it, so I did. He said, "Now, son, when I die, you got to preach two funerals for me." I said, "Two?" He said, "Yes." He said, "We got to have a funeral up here in Indiana where all the friends and people that I've been friends with all my life are all here. But then I want you to take me down to Florida and you can bury me in that sod of dirt down there. And you can have a funeral service for your church folks." And he said, "Put me in the cheapest casket you can find." I didn't, but I didn't obey Dad on that one. So I preached a funeral in La Porte, Indiana. And then we took his body down to the panhandle of Florida, and I preached his second funeral. This time with the burial service. And he's still there. Him and Mom. Mom died 4 years after Dad. Alzheimer's had set in. Since I'm doing this, and if I were writing a book, I would have to include this. When I was younger, I was very much a man driven by work, and I still am to a large degree, but I was driven by it. Dad found out he had pancreatic cancer in October of 1992. And he passed away on February 4 of 1993. So he lived 4 months. I was up to see him in February, or actually I guess it would have been the last few days of January. And I talked with the physician there at the hospital, and I said, "You know, I know you don't know, you're not God, it's only an educated guess, but what do you think? How long is he going to have? How long do I have to be with him?" And the doctor said, "Well, you're right, nobody knows. He could go tomorrow, he could go 6 months." But he said, "If I was making a guess," he said, "I think you would have at least 3 months before he passed." So it's coming up on a weekend, and I'm 1,000 miles away from my church. I went in and I talked to Dad, and I said, "I think I'm going to go back and preach to those folks on Sunday." And I'll see you next week. Dad said, "Well, you do that, son." I did. And I went back to see him next week. And the night before I arrived, he passed away. I wasn't there for him. And to make matters worse, I don't think it mattered a tinker's damn to the people that I went back to preach to one way or the other. I'll never forgive myself for that. My wife and I were at the bedside of my mom when she passed away. And I got to see her go home. But I live with that every day of my life. I've never preached this before. I don't think I'll ever preach it again. I just had you to know. I had to tell you about my dad. This man that stands in front of you each Sunday, is mainly here because of Edwin J. Baldwin. And I'm looking forward to the day when my dad and I can take that 1,000-year walk. And I know many of you have a dad and a mom that you love every bit as much as I love mine. And many of you have a dad and a mom that meant as much to you and taught you as much and helped you as much. If you have a mom or dad like that, it's sure something to be thankful for. All of us are who we are because of somebody. If you didn't have a mom or dad like that, then maybe you had a friend or a pastor or a teacher or somebody. Somebody God used to help you be who you are today. Where are none of us here? By accident, a mistake, coincidence, happenstance. God sent somebody to us to make us who we are. For me, it was my dad. Let's all stand for a word of prayer.